Hi everyone, it's Aliza Licht here, your host, and I'm so thrilled to share that my new book, On Brand, Shape Your Narrative, Share Your Vision, Shift Their Perception, is out now. I hope you'll pick up a copy because personal branding is for everyone. It's for the new graduate starting out, the middle manager looking to level up, the executive who wants to be a thought leader, the entrepreneur starting from scratch. It's for anyone who wants to pivot or transition into something new. Because having a strong personal brand means that your name gets dropped in rooms you're not in, and that you're thought of for opportunities that other people haven't even heard of yet. So pick up a copy, and I can't wait to hear what you think. Hi, this is Aliza Licht, and this is Leave Your Mark, the podcast, where I brew fresh career advice with some of my most inspiring and successful friends. It's professional advice that you can action immediately, whether you're just starting out in your career or well on your way. With a massive to-do list and a large cup of coffee, I promise that you can get it all done and still have time to post about it. I can't think of a better person to have on Leave Your Mark today. Now, obviously, this is being recorded, but today is the day that Meta just announced 11,000 people, or 13% of their workforce, being laid off. And this is on the heels of what Twitter just did. So let me introduce to you my personal attorney, Peter Raybar. He is a workplace legal expert who guides clients through the most important and often difficult decisions of their professional lives. He has represented individuals and major companies in nearly every aspect of employment law and other issues impacting the workplace. So we can list them out, but generally it's negotiation, investigation, litigation, mediation, including employment discrimination, harassment claims, layoffs, contracts, the gamut. Peter spent a big chunk of his career actually at Hearst, and we met through my college roommate, Robin, who is married to Peter. Pete, I mean, you are a busy guy, especially right this second.
Yeah.
So I think today we are going to dive in. This is going to be an extremely beneficial episode for everyone listening. I just want to caveat the whole thing by saying this is really mentorship. This is advice. This is not official legal advice. I brought Pete on not to give away his legal advice for free, but for you all, in case you are in a situation, to understand Pete is out there and lawyers like Pete are out there. However, this is not official legal advice. I am now covering myself on the Leave Your Mark podcast to say that. Peter, welcome to Leave Your Mark.
Thanks, Aliza. I'm happy to be here and talk about a whole host of issues that are happening right now. I love what I do because almost everybody works, right?
And
it's a big part of everybody's life. And the issues I deal with are things that impact individuals every day. So I like to think it's really useful, and I'm happy to share some tips.
We're going to cover some key areas. So we're going to cover layoffs. We're going to cover the new New York City pay transparency law and explain that. We're going to talk about how you prepare for all these things, what happens if you are laid off, mental health in the workplace, and in general, just ways to be really savvy about all of this. So on the heels of the Meta announcement, Pete, what would you say is the best way to prepare yourself for a layoff? Like, if you start hearing the rumblings in your company, what should you be doing?
Well, it's a complicated question because, you know, most people would think, oh, well, I should just prepare my resume and update my LinkedIn and be ready for the next thing. I think it's a little more nuanced than that. I'm not saying that there's ways to prevent yourself from getting laid off because there's no guarantee that that could even happen. But there's some things I definitely could suggest and some I would absolutely not suggest you do. The first is I wouldn't go to a manager and say, hey, I think I'm going to get laid off. Is that true? Is there anything I could do to save myself? I wouldn't be like a gossiper amongst your colleagues about it, because the reality is if there's a layoff that's going to happen, your manager's not going to be able to talk to you about it. They're not going to be able to make any guarantees, and they're not going to tell you if you're on the list or not. So that's a useless conversation that puts you in a bad frame of light with your manager, I think. instead, what I would focus on doing is, you know, despite the anxiety, just be as positive of a presence as you can in the workplace. Continue working as hard as you can. Continue being visible. Be a leader. And really hope that that resonates with the people you work for. That might be enough to keep you off a list, frankly. You know, doing your job well and being visible. So if you're debating about whether to go in one day or not, you should go in. If you're debating about going to a meeting that's not mandatory, you should go. If there's a social event or a speech or, you know, a panel, you should go. You should be really visible.
I just want to stop you there because I think this is really important. When the whole quiet quitting was like lighting up the internet, it's a very controversial topic, right? Because people are very adamant that their job is between X hours. And if they do their job, they're fine. And I maintain that if you're just doing your job, you're not protecting yourself against being on a layoff list as you could be. What is your POV?
I definitely think that's true. I agree with you 100%. And whether there's quiet quitting trends or not, I mean, that's just like something you should be mindful of. Like if you care about your job, if you love it, then you should do everything you can to show that to the people you work for. And that includes volunteering for things that are not, you know, sexy or popular with your colleagues. You'll get a lot of credit for that. I mean, when I started at Proskauer, the law firm I started my career at, you know, I wanted to be a sports lawyer. And there was a lot of people there who wanted to be sports lawyer. And all they wanted to do was work on sports cases. I volunteered to work on insurance cases, you know, just to show that I could work hard and do whatever was asked of me and travel around the country or whatever was needed. So if you care about your job, those are the things you're going to do. And certainly those things will be noticed. And certainly those things, I've sat with managers as they've made decisions on layoffs. They talk about that stuff. They talk about effort. They talk about enthusiasm. They talk about promoting company values. They talk about leadership. That's all there. You have humans making these decisions in most cases. So that's part of their decision-making process.
The visibility, I think, is really important. And I am a big proponent of camera on. Like, even if you're a remote employee, be engaged, have eye contact, show people that you care about the conversation and you actually value being part of that meeting. Do you think that that plays a role? I know for some people who are neurodivergent, being on camera and having to pay attention are two conflicting things. It's harder for people. Do you think it's fair, or what would you say in your opinion?
I don't think that's really going to be determinative of anything, but it's certainly a factor. You know, certainly if you have a disability or a condition that requires you to keep the camera off, then you should disclose that and everyone should know it. And then it absolutely should not be a factor.
That's a good point.
Otherwise, you should participate. I mean, you have to remember, most managers don't like remote work. They want you there, okay, in the office with them. If they're there, of course. And if you're not, you know, they really view it as making an accommodation for you. So turning the camera off is like almost adding insult to their injury of not having you in the office in the first place. So that's definitely not something I would suggest unless you absolutely had to do it.
When it comes to layoffs, I feel like employees don't really understand. They assume that people need to pay severance, that there should be a certain amount of weeks per year, but every company decides differently, right?
Absolutely. Some companies have severance plans. Most of the public companies have very well documented severance plans that you could look up. But in the United States, there's no legal requirement for severance. So it really falls to each company. And it also depends on the size of the layoff that's happening. So one of the things that was raised with the Twitter layoffs last week was something called the WARN Act. And the WARN Act is when a mass layoff happens. And certainly, depending on how the numbers break out for Facebook and Meta, you could argue it applies there too. But if a certain number of employees or percentage of employees are laid off at once, there is mandatory like notice period that needs to be provided. Now, that's not severance. That's a notice period. There is no mandatory severance. But most of the times in layoffs, there will be a standard package of severance that is offered. And there should be a criteria for determining each person's eligibility for severance, whether it's their years of service or their level in the company or some other factor. I've seen with a lot of startups, like, you know, they've only had employees for a few months or a few years. So they'll maybe just decide one number for everybody. Maybe that's fair. Maybe that isn't. But that's one component of it. Then there's usually some healthcare continuation. If people have equity, there's some consideration for what happens to their equity. So for instance, in the Meta layoff today, they let everybody hit their next vesting date, which is in a few weeks. So there's a lot of different elements that could be part of it, but the company decides. And the hope is that they decide consistently, which is something they would have to do to avoid potential liability.
So you do a mass layoff, but then you decide to selectively hire for those roles again. What does that look like?
I used to argue with clients about this all the time. Usually, if you lay someone off, there's also an agreement that comes with whatever severance, right? So they're going to put forward an agreement that says, we're going to give you these benefits and you're not going to sue us. And I strongly suggest that you have a lawyer look at one of those agreements if you are laid off and you're presented with one. But then, you know, eventually business is going to recover or change and the company's going to want to rehire people into some of those roles. Now, you need to look at your agreements. Some of these agreements say you're never allowed to apply for a job with us again.
That's harsh.
And there's some states that are trying to outlaw those provisions, but they exist. So, you know, if you really love the company, even if they lay you off, maybe you want to come back one day, you should check and make sure that that provision's not in the agreement.
What would be the reason why a company would want to institute that in the first place?
Well, basically, the theory is like, once we sign an agreement with you and settle all claims, we don't want you to come back and maybe be angry with the company or have an axe to grind and start causing trouble or whatnot. I think it's a pretty harsh measure. I mean, the reality is if you apply and someone really wants to hire you, they're going to be able to do it, release or not. But it's sort of a deterrent effect for people to move on. You know, the crazy thing that you rarely see is what happened at Twitter last week where they laid off everyone in what seems to be a very haphazard way. And then 2 days later started asking people to come back.
What do you actually make of it? I mean, it just seems like chaos.
It's insanity and it's cruel. That's what I would say. I mean, it's absolutely cruel to deal with people's livelihoods in that way. And by that, I mean, spending weeks speculating about firing, you know, half the company or more. People you don't even know, people who have presumably worked hard and care about working at Twitter, then doing it in such a callous way of like, you know, maybe you get an email in your personal account, maybe you get it in your work account, and just the intense rumors all week. And then asking people to come back, which just shows them you didn't really give it the thought that it deserved.
So crazy.
And by the way, that opens the company up to liability. And like most companies do everything possible to reduce their liability.
I mean, isn't there a class action suit already filed against Twitter?
Yeah, there was one filed early last week. Yeah. You know, there's one pending against Tesla. And just doing it that way just attracts class action lawyers. It attracts government agencies. It attracts unions. It's the last thing you want to do in that type of situation is attract that much attention.
I mean, it's bees to honey, literally. So if you're at, let's call it a normal company, and you get told that you are going to be laid off and this is your severance package, is there room for negotiation or is it just what it is? Like if you've been there 5 years and you feel like whatever the package is not sufficient based on your history and performance, can you negotiate or does it not even matter how long you've been there?
I think it's hardest in a layoff context to negotiate. If a lot of people are being let go and a package is set, you have to assume that some thought was put to that and they're not going to deviate unless there's a real reason to deviate. Now, that being said, I always tell clients, you should always ask because you don't want to be sitting in your apartment 6 months down the line, kicking yourself for not asking, right? The worst they could do is say no, they're not going to pull the offer. Now, if there are individual circumstances that should be addressed by the company, then those should be raised. And certainly I've seen companies address them. It could vary from like being involved in a difficult medical situation or having a particular family situation or having completed a really big project for the company just before the layoff. Or it could be, you know, you have a complaint pending or you filed a sexual harassment claim and somehow you ended up on the layoff list and your performance is otherwise amazing. So it doesn't really make sense. You know, those are really different cases. But if someone comes to me having been laid off, and I've had a lot of those calls this week, we try and figure out, you know, what's the angle in, who's the right person to have the call, and then what are we going to ask for? You know, I mean, that's basically the cadence.
And generally, when those situations arise, is it the employee that's sort of advocating for themselves, or do you actually contact the company on behalf of that client?
It depends on the circumstances. So if we're making a personal plea, I have a family situation or I have a medical situation, I always think that that is better to come from the employee.
For sure.
You know, and if it's a legal issue, then it needs to come from a lawyer. And what I tell my clients is if I make the call, it will be treated as a legal issue. And so we better be sure there's a legal issue. Otherwise, you're just, I think, wasting an opportunity to like convey some real emotion and real personal appeal.
Let's switch gears to the New York City pay transparency law that just came out. Can you explain what it is?
Sure.
Why it's important, if you believe it is, and then I can give you some of my own thoughts.
I believe it's important. I also think it's really funny, the like collective freak out that employers are having over it. And a lot of that is, you know, manufactured by my colleagues at law firms. But it's a real issue. And what it is a law that was passed in New York City and it has existed in a couple other states, including Colorado, which is notable because a lot of companies are hiring in Colorado now. And it requires an employer to post a good faith salary range, a base salary range. So minimum to max for a particular role that they advertise. And if it's an hourly job, then the hourly rate or the hourly range. And if they don't do it, then they are subject to fines and they have sort of one free shot to not do it and correct it. But then afterwards they could be fined up to $250,000 per violation.
And that's cute.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what kind of posting would merit a $250,000 violation, but that's the number everybody's fixated on. But look, it's important because pay equity issues still exist. They're very real. Most of my clients are women, so I can tell you that they're very real and we deal with them every day. People of color as well. So it's a real issue. New York City has tried to address this a number of ways. This is the second major way they're addressing it. You may remember a few years ago, they passed another law that people freaked out about, which was you can't ask candidates what their salaries were. You know, like this was the golden question that would determine whether someone was like good for your company or not. But everybody managed to deal with that. And everyone will manage to deal with this. And jobs that are placed with headhunters don't fall under this law. So that's not
Wait, what do you mean? I didn't know that.
Yeah. So like if a company wants to hire through a headhunter, they're not advertising for the job publicly. They're not posting it on their website. They're just offering it exclusively through a recruiter.
Oh, wow. That's
they don't have to publish the range.
Another thing I heard, tell me if this is true. I heard that the range is the range for the day that that job is posted, not necessarily the range for the day the job is filled. You can be below or higher than that range.
Sure. So it has to be a good faith estimate of what you would pay, but it doesn't mean you can't pay more or you can't pay less. And in fact, most of these postings you look at have disclaimers that say, we'll pay you based on experience, we'll aim for the middle of the range, et cetera. And the big piece it doesn't include is doesn't include benefits, doesn't include bonus, doesn't include equity.
Vacation.
Doesn't include stock. It doesn't include vacation. So like you look at a lot of jobs at startups or on Wall Street, you know, we're here in New York, the two big industries. A lot of those jobs have cap salaries. Like Amazon has a capped base salary. Everyone knows it. But the real magic in the comp is in what the stock options are or on Wall Street. that's bonuses, you know? So you still have a lot of wiggle room for employers. And I would say this also, like a lot of employees, and especially the younger generations, the newer generations in the workplace, they talk about salary freely.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for bringing this up. I want to repeat what you just said. Younger employees talk about salary in the office. This is absurd to me. This is absurd to you because this is not how we grew up. Why do they do that? And it is, to me, still highly inappropriate.
Yeah. I mean, they share everything. So like, why shouldn't they share their salary? I've seen spreadsheets. I've seen Google Docs. I've seen a lot of different data presented to me by, you know, some of my clients who are newer to the workforce that they have. And they just feel like it's a very us, meaning the employees, versus them, the company. So like the company has all the information. So why shouldn't we have all the information? And you could also trace some of that back to like a union environment where pay scales are published and everybody knows it. So there's a real tension there because certainly the older generations in the workplace don't believe in that. They're very guarded about what they make. They don't discuss it with their colleagues. It's a very competitive thing, but I think it's a good development. And I don't think it's like a freak out type event that it's being made out to be. So like, hopefully we'll see progress. I mean, we still need to make progress in this area. There's no doubt about it.
Wait, back to the spreadsheets though. I do take issue with that because those spreadsheets do not take into consideration experience. People right. are coming in with different levels of experience. So you can be a manager who's come in with 3 years of experience prior as a manager, or you could be someone who was a senior coordinator who's getting now managed up to a manager and is not going to be making the same salary. So I don't think it should be apples to apples at all.
That's really where the companies need to invest some time with their managers to have reasonable discussions about this stuff. And a lot of managers feel really uncomfortable talking about comp more than once a year, right? So true. I work with companies that have operations in Colorado. So we've sort of seen how this works. So what we'll come forward and say inevitably, hey, this role you advertise pays a lot more than mine. What's the situation? And sometimes it's even like a totally different job. So a 2-minute conversation there about like, thank you for bringing that forward. Let me explain. That's a totally different job. So it has a totally different set of requirements, totally different set of experience. Or, you know, the example you raised, that there may be different salaries paid for different experience levels. That's not reflected in what you brought forward, but thank you for sharing that. You know, I think these are moments to just build trust and credibility with employees. You know, they're not easy, but like they can be handled. It just takes a little more effort, but you make a good point. I mean, there is a danger that someone just looks at it and flips out and maybe sure. quits or whatever.
Well, the other thing that's happening now with this transparency is people are looking at the job postings for their same title at another company, maybe a competitor, maybe not, and then going back to management and saying, hey, this person at so-and-so company with the same title is making more than me. Can you speak to that? Because I also think there needs to be like a level setting of understanding that companies are not created equal. Not every company has to standardize pay across a title. At yep. LVMH, a director is one of the most senior titles you can have. At another company, that might be more junior in the scheme right. of the hierarchy.
That type of conversation, I would say you'd have to tread very carefully. And you'd have to think about, you know, what is the data we're using and what is my objective here? So just showing up out of the blue with a job listing from another company and demanding more pay or asking questions about yours, I think is like a really stupid idea. And I would never tell anyone to do that. Okay. And I think it's not a career enhancing, as I would say. But, you know, let's say you're in a real position where you feel like you're being underpaid. And you felt that for a while. And where I've dealt with this issue a lot with doctors, actually, you know, they take blended market data and they say, you know, based on what I do and how many procedures, I should be paid X. And I'm paid X minus, you know, whatever. That's a discussion you can have around comp time when you think it's right, and you would come in with a lot of data. You wouldn't come in with one random job posting. So I think the person with the one job posting, if that's what they're going to do, then they should be prepared to be told, we'll go apply for that job and see if you can get it. And of course, you and I know probably dozens or hundreds of people who have gotten job offers and have come back and said, hey, I got this job offer for this much more money. Do you want to match it? And then a company can decide whether they want to do that or not.
Yes, but you must be prepared to leave when you do that.
Gotta be. Like, have all your contacts downloaded.
Totally. Well, you know, it's funny. I've definitely worked at places where triggers go off when you start downloading stuff. So that's another thing to think about. It's a really obvious red flag when people start doing that. Like, oh, they're getting ready to leave.
Yeah. Every workplace discussion has to be taken seriously. I mean, if you're talking about your comp or you're talking about promotions or you're talking about how you're being treated, it's part of why I do what I do, because people don't take these conversations seriously and they don't realize. It's like you go and you talk to your manager about an HR issue. So what happens? The manager goes and talks to HR. HR goes and talks to a lawyer. A lawyer talks to HR and the manager. Then they come up with a plan and talking points. And here you are, this person who just like totally unprepared, like sauntered in with something, not ready for the resources that you're now facing on the other side. So I work with a lot of people who haven't quit. They're in jobs, you know, and they just need guidance on how to have difficult conversations. But like, you have to be serious. It's your job. It's your livelihood. You have to be serious about it.
Absolutely. Let's turn over the conversation to harassment, of which there are many kinds of harassment. If you are someone who has an abusive boss, feels like someone is not treating them appropriately, what's the order of operations in managing that? And when does an attorney come into play?
Well, harassment continues to be a really serious issue in our workplace. And we just had the anniversary of Me Too movement starting. And unfortunately, there was a lot of stories that came out in the last few weeks about how companies have sort of faded in their treatment of these issues and how seriously they take them. But my advice is this: if you're in a situation where you feel like you're not being treated fairly, or you're being discriminated against, or you're being harassed, you need to talk to someone about it. Okay. And if you work at a good company, they will handle it with the respect that it deserves. But you can't just assume that that's going to happen without you taking that first step. And as I just said, you know, a few minutes ago, I don't think you should take that first step without talking to a lawyer. I'm not saying go hire one for every little thing that happens, but, you know, maybe you know one, you can talk to one. Maybe you know someone who works in HR at another company and get their opinion on it. But I really think you need to have a plan. If you're going to raise an issue where you're bringing someone else's conduct into focus for a company, then you need to be ready with what will come next, which is a potential investigation, meetings with HR, meetings with lawyers, potentially, you know, depending on the severity of the issue, it could go a lot of different ways. Some issues just are resolved by like a mediation between two people in the workplace, you know, like they're not that serious. Some are really serious and deserve a different type of treatment, but I don't think you should keep it to yourself. And I strongly suggest you talk to someone and get like a gauge from an outsider on what your next step should be. Because, I mean, this is why we have anti-harassment laws. Everybody should be able to come into work, feel safe, feel like they're being treated respectfully and equally and free from harassment and discrimination. That's what the laws say. So you have that protection. Pretty much every company in the US has a policy that says the same thing. And it's important to stand up for yourself.
I had a guest maybe last year, Lori Siegel. She's in the media industry. And on the episode, she talks about discrimination and harassment from the perspective of death by a thousand cuts. So nothing that's so flagrant that you can like point to it, but it's little things over and over again that really mess with your mental health. if someone feels like there's like these tiny little things, but there's not massive proof and you don't have an email and you don't have like, you know, I mean, it used to be back in the day, like a ranting voicemail message from your boss or whatever it is.
Right.
And let's say it is your direct manager. How do you tackle that when it's more abstract?
Those are really hard cases to handle. I've certainly worked with a number of people, been at companies for 10, 15 years and felt that course of treatment. And they're now in a place where they can't deal with it anymore. And that's one of the things the pandemic has really brought to the surface. Part of the quote, great resignation, which I hate that terminology, by the way, I like to call it the ultimate reset, because it's really forced people to think beyond the parameters they set for themselves before. And so maybe someone before was thinking, well, it's nothing serious that's going to get this person fired or get me a settlement. And I still need to work. So I'm just going to put my head down and plow through it and hope it changes. But now people aren't willing to do that anymore. You know, now more people are saying, why do I have to put up with this? Why do I have to put up with this job? Why do I have to put up with this person? Why do I have to put up with this company? Mm-hmm. And it doesn't always mean filing a complaint and getting the person fired. For some people, it may be like, you know what? I could move to a new job. I'm not running away from a problem. I'm going to somewhere where I feel respected. I'm treated well. I'm paid what I'm supposed to be paid. And I could feel like I have some control over my life and career. And that's very empowering, you know, and a lot of people would disagree with that, but that's one route people take. The problem in these cases where there's a lot of little actions and maybe there's microaggressions and other types of promotions that you're passed over for or pay equity issues. I mean, you can dig in and fight and prove that out. And people have done that. The law is just so far behind on this stuff that it becomes very difficult. And a lot of lawyers are just very mechanical and sort of look for the big things. And, you know, they say, well, you know, you were still able to work. So how bad could it have been? So I've worked with people in a number of different ways in those situations. And I'd say, like, if it's not a situation where we can get you to a new position, maybe in the company, or get your boss to a different position or out, then maybe you want to seriously consider, like, is this the right place for me even? I've had that discussion a lot with clients and we've gone a lot of different ways. But what really makes it difficult is just the law is just still so far behind.
So fascinating. Pete, people are mostly at-will employees, right? So they can technically be fired for any reason at any time, right? Without cause.
As long as it's not an illegal reason, so a discriminatory or other retaliatory reason, then yes, that's true. And as long as someone doesn't have a contract that says different.
So if you're fired from a job and you have no idea why, or they make up some excuse that you're like, I didn't do that. That's not to say that it's necessarily illegal, but like they're basically painting a picture that is inaccurate. What does someone do?
I would talk to a lawyer immediately. If a company is making up excuses to fire you, then there's definitely something else going on. So that's one. If you have no clue why you were fired, that's also a problem. And I used to have that conversation with managers all the time. You know, they would come to me and say, hey, we want to terminate X person. I still represent some companies, so I still have these conversations. And I say, okay, have you talked to them? Do they know that their job is on the line? Do they know this is coming? And if they say to me, no, they're going to be very surprised, then that's probably where I'll take the biggest stand with a client and say, why? You know, why will they be surprised? And why are we doing this if that's the case? And so if there's like a financial reason, the company's going through financial hardship or something like that, that's one thing. But sometimes you do digging and you find other reasons that are motivating it, that they may be illegal or they may not be illegal, but the company still wants to not have them be publicly aired. So there's some discussion to be had around those points. And so, you know, look, if you're terminated and you're offered severance, you're going to have an agreement put in front of you. You should certainly have someone look at that. Certainly there's a lot of people who have non-competes and other non-solicitation agreements. If you're terminated, we want to work hard to make sure that those are wiped out. You shouldn't be hindered from finding a new job if the company is terminating you. So there's a lot of things to look at that you may not be thinking of. That's why I think it's really important to talk to a lawyer in that situation and go through all of it. You know, I have conversations with clients and they tell me things they don't even realize are like improper. And then they're like, oh, I didn't know that they couldn't do that. You know, those are great moments for me to prove my value, but I feel bad because I know a lot of people don't hire lawyers and don't have these discussions and just sign documents and move on and then have a problem down the line.
Yes, especially with non-competes. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I do a lot of work in non-competes. I help a lot of people get out of their non-competes and I help a lot of companies enforce their non-competes. So it's really pretty interesting work. But I would say there's a couple areas where I think New York needs to take action and other states have already taken action, you know, to ban non-competes for people making under a certain salary threshold. You know, Illinois just passed the law banning them under 75,000. I think New York should do something similar. I've done some work with the New York City Bar to advocate for that. I mean, people making under, you know, $75,000 or, you know, maybe it should be a little higher in New York. They're not going to go hire lawyers to fight non-competes. They're just going to be blocked out of certain jobs. And that's just not right. So I think some work needs to be done there. As I said, I've represented a lot of female clients. And, you know, frankly, these non-competes can be used as tools to perpetuate discrimination and harassment issues, even if someone decides to leave a company. And so we do a lot of fighting behind the scenes about that issue in particular. And I think it's a really interesting issue that hasn't received a lot of attention, but non-competes are serious. Like people sign them very haphazardly and you don't pay attention to it. And I think it's worth everybody's effort to like take a look and really understand. And some people are totally comfortable with them, but you should at least understand what you're getting into. And if you're fired, you should get out of it.
The other document that people don't take very seriously is the non-disclosure agreement in the employee onboarding as well.
Right. I mean, most companies now, they don't wait until they fire you to put one in front of you. They put it in front of you when they hire you.
Yes.
And I've been having a lot of battles over this lately. They're in employment contracts where they say, you can't disparage a company. And I say, well, what about like in a performance review? If we have a disagreement, my client says, you know, you don't know how to evaluate my work or... And so then we have to come out with all these like ridiculous carve outs. But yeah, these things exist. They're enforced. You see them a lot in the social media context in your world. You know, someone posts something on LinkedIn or Instagram and they think it's their personal time and their personal account and it's negative against the company or unflattering to the reputation of the company. That could serve as a basis to, you know, discipline you, terminate you. It needs to be taken seriously for sure.
You actually reminded me of what I wanted to ask you before, which was if someone posts something on their personal social media, not about the company, but it is something that either there are projects being worked on behind the scenes that this employee doesn't know about, or the person is just putting themselves under a spotlight where the company doesn't want the association. We see people get fired for that kind of thing all the time. Is that just like all the time? So companies need no real reason to do that. They can literally just cite the post and call it a day.
Companies have policies about not posting things on social media, not revealing confidential information, not putting the company in a negative light. If you're a high-level executive, you definitely have that in your agreements, not doing things that are unflattering to the company. And we see people get terminated for that all the time. And, you know, you have to pay particular attention to your profile. So does your profile identify you as an employee of a specific company? Would your posts potentially identify you as an employee of a specific company? Or are you just like a public figure who is associated with a company? And there was one recently where an executive of Apple, a very high-level executive, was not even on his own TikTok. It was on a TikTok yeah. account posted a video interview with him where he said something that was actually, it was a movie quote, but it was a very lewd movie quote, and he got fired.
Yes.
And I could tell you 1,000 different versions of that story. I've counseled clients who have fired employees for things they posted on their Instagram stories. I just recently worked with a client who had a low-level employee post something like a racist comment on LinkedIn. You know, I mean, it still happens all the time. It seems so basic.
It's so basic. Nobody learns that. Well, hopefully people listening to this episode will learn, but it seems yeah. like how many examples of this do people need before they absorb the fact that what they put out online, they are responsible for and can cost them their job?
Yeah. And exists for forever, basically. Yeah. You know, I mean, it can't be erased and it's forever associated with you and who you work for. I mean, it's like not too hard to like put together where you work, right?
It's
like
not.
It's really not.
I like to say the internet is written in a Sharpie.
Yeah, I saw your video on that.
Yes.
I was like, perfect.
Yes, yes. Thank you. Let's switch gears to positive things like offers with
right.
new jobs. How hard should you negotiate? Especially now, right? You know the quote unquote band, you know the minimum, you know the maximum. But let's just say you feel like you have more experience than that. You're worth more than that. What's the protocol?
Well, a lot of it's going to be dependent on where you are in your career and what type of job you're coming in at. So I have different advice for all groups, you know, and I'd say if you're just starting out or, you know, in the first few years of employment, don't spend too much time pushing back on terms. You know, certainly you want to make sure you're paid fairly. And if you're promised something that it's documented, I think that's really important. But the company is not going to spend a lot of energy on negotiating offer letters with entry level or very junior people. Like, you just need to be realistic. If you're asked to sign something, certainly you should review it and make sure it's consistent with whatever you're supposed to get. Now, if you're more senior, I would say this is your time. When you have that offer in hand, this is your greatest moment of leverage. Now, what I just said is really important when you have that offer in hand, because you want to get that offer. You want the company to want you, right? Like, you want to be in that position. They found their mate. They went through a process. They spent money on recruiters. They spent time interviewing dozens of people and they chose you. So now you have an offer in hand and you absolutely should negotiate, because this is your moment of greatest leverage. So let's figure out what makes sense. Let's be reasonable. Let's see what they offer and make sure that it's actually what they're telling you they're going to give you. I talk to a lot of people who, like, C-suite level people who are afraid to negotiate. And I'm just like, what are you afraid of? Do you think the CEO took his or her job without negotiating their employment agreement? Of course not. So I love having that conversation with people and sort of bringing them around to my side. And then we sort of get in it together and figure out what's right for them.
Do you find yourself typically doing that behind the scenes and you're sort of feeding the employee what to say, or are you actually speaking on behalf of your client?
So I like to stay behind the scenes as much as possible. I'm very sensitive to how these things go. I'm very sensitive to how executives could react to things differently. So I'm happy to stay behind the scenes as much as possible and work on documents and provide bullet points and provide data to my clients. And if they're capable and comfortable, they'll go forward and have those discussions directly with HR, with a particular executive. Now, some clients, they don't want to do that. They don't feel comfortable talking about comp with someone they're working with or other things. And, you know, they just want me to do the whole thing. And we can do that too. I mean, that's no problem. But
yeah.
I would rather be behind the scenes as much.
Wizard
as
of Oz, for sure.
Yeah.
I think also, no offense, Pete, people, when they see your email, they're like, oh, this is going to be.
Yeah, they get very scared.
They get scared. They know you're going to be a pain in the ass. It changes the whole dynamic of the conversation. No offense.
Yeah. No, and look, I used to work with like magazine editors who were like, oh, wait, you're a lawyer? You actually seem like a normal person. I'm like, oh, thanks so much. So I'm definitely tuned into that too. Like, business people don't like dealing with lawyers if they don't have to. And I don't take any offense.
Yeah. This was amazing. You're a wealth of information. Where can people find you?
Well, I have my own firm, the Raybar Group. So if you go to theraybargroup.com, that's my website. It has all my contact information. And I'm also on LinkedIn and Instagram and whatnot. And I'm launching a newsletter in a few weeks. So we'll
amazing.
Come back on and talk about that.
All right. Last question. How do you ultimately want to leave your mark?
I just really want to be an advocate and I want to help people make good decisions. That comes from growing up as a child of immigrants and being first generation American and like not having a lot of information at my disposal as I navigated my way through life. And I want to help people make better decisions at work, in their careers. It's a very satisfying aspect of what I do. I mean, the relationships I have with my clients now, and I represent mostly individuals, are very, very deep and meaningful. And so that's what I'm working towards. It's a fun journey so far.
Well, you're doing an amazing job. And I'm lucky to have you as both friend and lawyer. All right. Well, this was awesome.
You're a great client, by the way. Everyone should know that. You're a great client.
I'm not an annoying client, I will say.
No, never, never.
Thanks, Pete. Thanks for coming on the show.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for listening to Leave Your Mark, the podcast. If you want more career advice, be sure to pick up a copy of my best-selling book, Leave Your Mark. If you're on Instagram, make sure to follow at Leave Your Mark Podcast to stay up with the latest episodes. And of course, say hi to me at Aliza Licht XO. If you're on Twitter, definitely reach out at Aliza Licht. I would love to hear from you. If you want to subscribe to my newsletter or attend a future virtual mentoring event, go to alizalicht.com for more information. And just remember this, if change doesn't hurt a little, it's not change. Keep on rocking.